Chapter 10. In the dawn, as Sean cleaned his face with a cloth dipped in a mug of hot water, regarding its reflection in the small metal mirror, the only fact that gave him the faintest satisfaction was the 200-odd sovereigns he had salvaged from the night's debauch.
"Are you sick, Pa?"
Dirk's ghoulish interest in Sean's condition added substantially to his evil temper. "Eat your breakfast." Sean's tone was calculated by its sheer malevolence to dry up further questioning. "There is no food." Impajani fell into the familiar role of protector. "Why not?" Sean focused his bloodshot eyes upon him.
"There is one among us who considers the purchase of strong drink and other things more important than food for his son."
From the pocket of his jacket, Sean drew a handful of sovereigns. "Go," he ordered. "Buy food and fresh horses. Go quickly, so that in my grave illness I may not be afflicted with the wisdom of your counsel. Take Dirk with you." Bijani examined the money and grinned. "The night was not wasted." When they had gone back to Freya, Dirk trotting beside the huge half-naked Zulu, and his voice only fading at a distance of 100 yards, Sean poured himself another mug of coffee, and cupping it in his hands, he sat staring into the ash and pink coals of the fire. He could trust Impajani to use the money with care. He had the bargaining patience peculiar to his race, that could, if necessary, devote 2 days to the purchase of a single ox. These things did not concern Sean now. Instead, he went over the events of the previous night. Still sickened by his display of murderous rage, he tried to justify it. Taking into account the loss of nearly all he owned, the accumulation of years of hard work that had been stripped from him in a single day, the hardship and uncertainty that had followed. And finally, he had reached the flashpoint when liquor and poker-tensed nerves had snapped the last reserve in him and translated it all into that violent outburst. But that was not all. He knew he had avoided the main issue. Ruth. As he came back to her, a wave of hopeless longing overwhelmed him, a tender despair such as he had never experienced before. He groaned aloud, and lifted his eyes to the morning star, which was fading on the pink horizon as the sun came up behind. For a while longer he wallowed in the softness of his love, remembering the way she walked, the dark serenity of her eyes, and her mouth when she smiled and her voice when she sang, until it threatened to smother him in its softness. Then he sprang to his feet and paced restlessly in the grass beside the fire. "We must leave this place. Ride away from it. Go quickly. I must find something to do, some way to keep from thinking of it, something to fill my hands which ache now from the need to hold her." Along the road, going north to Colenso, a long column of infantry filed past him in the dawn. He stopped his pacing and watched them. Each man leaned forward against his pack, and the rifles stood up behind their shoulders. "Yes," he thought, "I will go with them. Perhaps at the place to which they march I can find what I could not find last night. We will go home to Ladyburg, riding hard on fresh horses. I will leave Dirk with my mother, then come back to this war." He began to pace again impatiently. Where the hell was Imbajani? From the heights above, Sean looked down on Ladyburg. The village spread in a neat circle around the spire of the church. He remembered the spire as beacon bright in its cladding of new copper, but 19 years of weather had dulled it to a mellow brown. 19 years. It did not seem that long. There were goods yards around the station now, a new concrete bridge over the Baboonstroom. The blue gums in the plantation beyond the school were taller, and the flamboyants that had lined the main street were gone. With a strange reluctance, Sean turned his head and looked out to the right, across the Baboonstroom, close in against the escarpment, to where he had left the sprawling Dutch-gabled homestead of Tunniskraal, with its roof of combed yellow thatch and the shutters of yellow wood across the windows. It was there, but not as he remembered it. Even at this distance he could see the walls were flaking and mottled with patches of dampness. The thatch was shaggy as the coat of an Airedale. One of the shutters tilted sharply from a broken hinge. The lawns were brown and ragged, where the bare earth showed through. The dairy behind the house had crumbled, its roof gone, and the remains of its walls jutted forlornly upwards to the height of a man's shoulder. "Damn the little bastard!" Sean's anger flared abruptly, as he saw the neglect with which his twin brother had treated the lovely old house. "He's so lazy he wouldn't get out of bed he's peed in." To Sean, it was not just a house. It was the place his father had built, which had sheltered Sean on the day of his birth and through the years of his childhood. When his father died under the Zulu spears at Ishlanzwana, half the farm and the house had belonged to Sean. He had sat in the study at nights with the logs burning in the stone fireplace and the mounted buffalo head above it, throwing distorted moving shadows up to the plaster ceiling. Although he had given his share away, yet it was still his home. Gary, his brother, had no right to let it decay and fall apart this way. "Damn him!" Sean voiced his thoughts out loud. Then almost immediately his conscience rebuked him. Gary was a cripple, his lower leg shot away by the blast of a careless shotgun. And Sean had fired that shotgun. Will I never be free of that guilt? How long must my penance continue? He protested at the goad of his conscience. That is not your only trespass against your brother, his conscience reminded him. Who sired the child he calls his son? Whose loins sowed the seed that became man-child in the belly of Anna, your brother's wife? It has been a long time, Nkosi. Imbajani had seen the expression on his face as Sean looked towards Tunis Kraal and remembered those things from the past that were better forgotten. Yes, Sean roused himself and straightened in the saddle. A long road and many years, but now we are home again. He looked back towards the village, searching the quarter beyond the main street and the hotel for the roof of that little cottage on Protea Street. As he found it, showing through the tall, fluffy blue gum trees, there was a lift in his mood, a new excitement. Did she still live there? How would she look? A little grey, surely. Had her 50 years marked her deeply? Or had they treated her with the same consideration which she showed all those with whom she came in contact? Had she forgiven him for leaving without a farewell? Had she forgiven his long years of silence since then? Did she understand the reasons why he had never written? No word or message, except that anonymous gift of £10,000 he had transferred to her bank account. 10,000 miserable little pounds, which he had hardly noticed among all the millions he had won and lost in those days long ago when he was one of the lords of the Witwatersrand goldfields. Again the sense of guilt closed in upon him, as he knew with utter certainty that she had understood, that she had forgiven. For that was Ada, the woman who was his stepmother, and whom he loved beyond the natural love one owes their own full-blooded mother. "Let's go down," he said, and kicked his horse to a canter.
"Is this home, Pa?"
Dirk shouted as he rode beside him.
"Yes, my boy, this is home."
"Will Grandma be here?"
"I hope so," Sean answered, and then softly, "Beyond all other things, I hope that she will."
Over the bridge above the Baboonstroom, past the cattle pens alongside the line of rail, past the old wood and iron station buildings with the sign white and black faded to grey, Ladyburg, altitude 2,256 feet above sea level, swinging left into the dusty main street, which was wide enough to turn a full span of oxen, and down to Protea Street, rode Sean and Dirk, with Mbijani and the pack mule trailing far behind. At the corner, Sean checked his mount to a walk, drawing out the last few minutes of anticipation until they stopped outside the wicket fence of white that encompassed the cottage. The garden was neat and green, gay with beds of Barberton daisies and blue rhododendrons. The cottage had been enlarged, a new room built on the far side, and it was crisp-looking in a coat of new whitewash. A sign at the gate said in gold letters on a green ground, "Maison Ada, high-class costumier." Sean grinned. "The old girl's gone all French, by God." Then to Dirk, "Stay here." He swung down from his horse, handed the reins to Dirk, and went through the gate. At the door he paused self-consciously and adjusted his cravat. He glanced down at the severe dark broadcloth suit and new boots which he had purchased in Pietermaritzburg, slapped the dust from his breeches, stroked his newly trimmed beard into place, gave his moustache a twirl, and knocked on the door. It was opened at last by a young lady. Sean did not recognise her. But the girl reacted immediately, flushing slightly, attempting to pat her hair into place without drawing attention to its disarray, trying to dispose of the sewing in her hands, and exhibiting all the signs of confusion peculiar to the unmarried female who finds herself suddenly and unexpectedly in the presence of a large, well-dressed and attractive male. But Sean felt a twinge of pity as he looked at her scarred face, ugly with the purple cicatrice of acne. Sean lifted his hat.
"Is Mrs. Courtney here?"
"She's in the workroom, sir. Who shall I tell her is calling?"
"Don't tell her anything. It's a surprise."
Sean smiled at her, and she lifted her hand self-consciously in an attempt to mask the ruin of her face.
"Won't you come in, sir?"
She turned her head aside shyly, as though to hide it.
"Who is it, Mary?"
Sean started at the voice from the depths of the cottage. It hadn't changed at all, and the years dropped away.
"It's a gentleman, Aunt Ada. He wants to see you."
"I'm coming. Ask him to sit down, and please bring us coffee, Mary."
Mary escaped thankfully, and left Sean standing alone in the small sitting room, twisting his hat in big brown hands, staring up at the daguerreotype print of Waite Courtney above the mantel. Although he did not recognize the fact, the face of his father in the picture was almost his own. The same eyes under heavy black brows, the same arrogance about the mouth, even the identical thrust of stubbornness in the jaw beneath the thick spade-shaped beard, and the big hooked Courtney nose. The door from the workroom opened, and Sean swung quickly to face it. Ada Courtney came through it smiling until she saw him. Then she stopped, and the smile died on her lips, and she paled. Uncertainly, her hand lifted to her throat, and she made a small choking sound.
"Dear God," she whispered.
"Ma," Sean fidgeted his feet awkwardly.
"Hello, Ma. It's good to see you."
"Sean." The colour flooded back into her cheeks. For a moment I thought, "Oh, you've grown so much like your father." "Oh, Sean!"
And she ran to him, tossed his hat onto the sofa, and caught her around the waist as she came.
"I've waited for you. I knew you'd come."
Sean scooped her up and kissed her into a confusion of joy and laughter, swinging her while he did it, laughing himself.
"Put me down, put me down," Ada gasped at last.
And when he did, she clung to him.
"I knew you'd come back.
At first there were bits in the newspaper about you, and people told me things, but these last years there's been nothing, nothing at all." "I'm sorry," Sean sobered. "You're a bad boy." She was sparkling with excitement. Her hair had escaped from its bun, and a wisp of it hung down her cheek.
"But it's so good to have you back."
And suddenly she was crying.
"Don't, Ma, please, don't."
He had never seen her cry before.
"It's just that... It's the surprise."
She brushed impatiently at her tears. It's
nothing."
Desperately, Sean sought something to distract her. "Hey," he exclaimed with relief, "I've another surprise for you."
"Later," she protested. "One at a time."
"Oh, well, this won't wait." He led her to the door and out onto the front stoop, with his arm around her shoulders.
"Dirk," he shouted, "come here."
He felt her standing very still as they watched Dirk coming up the garden walk.
"This is your grandma," he introduced them.
"Why is she crying?"
Dirk eyed her with frank curiosity. Later they sat at the table in the kitchen while Ada and Mary plied them with food. Ada Courtney believed that the first thing to do with a man was to feed him. Mary was almost as excited as Ada. She had taken full advantage of the few minutes she had been alone, and now her hair was freshly brushed, and she wore a gay new apron. But the powder with which she had tried to cover the terrible disfiguration of the skin served only to call attention to it. In sympathy, Sean refrained from looking at her, and Mary noticed. Shyly, she devoted herself to winning Dirk's attention. She fussed over him quietly, and Dirk accepted this as the natural order of things. While they ate, Sean filled in the missing years for Ada with a brief outline of his activities, glossing over the death of Dirk's mother and other things of which he had no reason to be proud. He came to the end of it.
"And so here we are. Home is the sailor home from the sea, and the hunter home from the hill.
Dirk, don't put so much in your mouth and keep it closed when you chew.
How long will you stay? Mary, see if there are any cream puffs in the jar. Dirk's still hungry, said Ada.
You'll make him sick. I don't know. Not long enough. There's a war on, you know.
You going to join?
Yes.
Oh, Sean, must you?
Knowing that he must.
While he selected a cheroot from his case, Sean studied her closely for the first time. There was grey now, as he had known there would be, almost as much grey as black. Long streaks of it across her temples, and the texture of her skin had altered, losing the moisture of youth, drying out so that it creased around the eyes and stretched tight across her hands to show the knuckles more prominently and the blueness of the veins beneath it. She was plumper also. Her bosom was full and round, each breast having lost its separate identity in the whole. Yet the other qualities whose memories he had treasured so long ago still persisted, seemed indeed to have grown stronger. The composure which showed in the stillness of her hands and body, yet was given the lie by the humour that hovered around her lips. The eyes whose depths held compassion and a sure understanding of those things they looked upon. But mostly it was the indefinable aura of goodness about her. Looking at her, he sensed again that behind those eyes no destructive thought could live for long. Sean lit the cheroot and spoke while the smoke masked his face. Yes, Ma, I must go. And Ada, whose husband had ridden to war also, and not ridden home, could not prevent the sadness showing for an instant in her eyes. Yes, sir. I suppose you must. Gary has gone already. And Michael has been agitating to follow him.
Michael? Sean fired the question.
Gary's son. He was born a short while after you left Ladyburg. He'll be 18 this winter.
Oh, what's he like? Sean's voice was too eager. Michael. So that is what my son is named. My firstborn. By God, my firstborn. And I didn't even know his name until he was almost fully grown. Ada was looking at him with her own question unasked in her eyes.
Mary, take Dirk through to the bathroom, please. Try and get a little of that food from around his mouth.
When they had gone, she answered Sean's question.
He's a tall boy, tall and lean, dark, like his mother, but a serious lad. He doesn't laugh much. Always top of his class. I like him very much. He comes here often.
She was silent for a moment. Then,
Sean cut in. And how's Gary?
He sensed what she was going to ask.
Gary has not changed very much. He's had a run of bad luck. Poor Gary, things have been bad on the farm. The rinderpest ravaged his herds. He had to borrow money from the bank.
She hesitated an instant.
And he's drinking a lot these days. I can't be sure of it. He never visits the hotel, and I have never seen him take a drink. But it must be that.
I'll find out where he is when I go up to Colenso.
Oh, you'll have no difficulty finding him. Gary is a lieutenant colonel on the general staff. He was given promotion from major last week, and he has been awarded the Distinguished Service Order to go with his Victoria Cross. He's in charge of liaison between the Imperial and the Colonial troops.
Good God! Sean was stunned.
Gary, a colonel? General Buller thinks very highly of him. The general is also a holder of the Victoria Cross.
But, Sean protested,
you know how Gary got that decoration. It was a mistake. If Gary is on the general's staff, then Lord have mercy on the British Army.
Sean, you mustn't talk about your brother that way.
Colonel Garrick Courtney,
Sean laughed out loud.
I don't know what there is between you and Gary, but it's something very nasty, and I don't want any of it in this house.
Ada's tone was fierce, and Sean stopped laughing.
I'm sorry. Before we close the subject, I want to warn you. Please be very careful how you handle Gary. Whatever happened between you two, and I don't know what it was, Gary still hates you. Once or twice he started talking about you, but I stopped him. Yet I know it from Michael. The boy has picked it up from his father. It's almost an obsession with him. Be careful of Gary.
Ada stood up.
And now about Dirk. What a lovely child he is, Sean, but I'm afraid you've spoiled him a little.
Yes, he's a tiger,
Sean admitted.
What schooling has he been given?
Well, he can read a little.
You'll leave him here with me. I'll enroll him when the school term begins.
I was going to ask. I'll leave money with you.
10 years ago, there was a very large and mysterious deposit to my bank account. It wasn't mine, so I placed it out at interest.
She smiled at him, and Sean looked guilty.
We can use that.
No,
he said.
Yes, she contradicted.
And now tell me when you're leaving.
Soon.
How soon?
Tomorrow.